Hi everyone and welcome to the Supporting Champions podcast. Don't forget to subscribe on YouTube, on iTunes or at supportingchampions.co.uk to get these performance insights straight to your inbox. In this recording, taken from the 2017 Supporting Champions Conference, strength and conditioning coach Nick Grantham shares his insights about the characteristics of a successful coach.
Let's start off. What I want you to do, I want you to imagine that you are an elite gymnast. Now looking at the crowd, for some of you that may be a bit more of a leap of faith than others, okay? So to help you on that sort of imaginary journey, let's scrub 17 years off your life. So let's go back to the 2000, and it is July, and you are preparing for Sydney Olympics. You're the best British gymnast. You've won the British Championships. You've been training for 12 to 15 years, best part of your life, 2 to 3 times a day, 5 to 6 times a week. You're unstoppable. You have won 2 of the 3 Olympic trials, and essentially your name is printed on that aeroplane ticket for the one spot as a male gymnast to go to the Olympics. You're in. It's July the 5th, it's Wednesday afternoon, fairly standard day, third session of the day, and you come towards the end of the session, it's about 5:45, and you're training and you're on parallel bars, small apparatus on the floor, just working through one of the routines, just grooving something, dead simple, really simple routine, working through, and then all of a sudden you slip. Your hand impacts into the floor, 2 bones break in your hand, and your chances and dreams and aspirations of being an Olympian disappear. If we fast forward to September the 20th, I'm asleep, I'm getting my head down at home, I'm sleeping, it's about 2 o'clock in the morning, and the blower goes, the phone, for those of you that aren't from the south, phone goes, and it's never good news, is it? It's never good news at 2 o'clock in the morning when you get a phone call. So I'm scrambling around, picking the phone up, and I immediately recognise the voice on the end of the phone, and in a broad Burnley accent, he says, "Nick, I'm in the Olympic finals." What I want to talk about today, and it resonates a lot with what Steve has talked about and what Barry's looked at, is those sort of coaching skill sets. The coaching skill sets that the sports science and medical team, the multidisciplinary team that started working with that gymnast when he broke his hand, to get them onto the Olympics and go to the Olympic finals, the skills that they possess. Everyone at conferences currently loves talking about data, big data, massive data, algorithms and spreadsheets and system mass volume loads. Everyone's nosing on stuff like that. And that's important, and you have to have that. But ultimately, a lot of it comes down to this, coaching. We are coaches. Whether you are a sports scientist, a physiologist, biomechanist, nutritionist, teacher, ultimately you're a coach, okay? I looked up what coach meant, and these are the things that come out. These are the words that come out for us. It's about helping. We're all in this room because we want to help people. We want to make them improve. We want to make people better. We overcome life-changing. People making squads, not making teams. Winning medals, not winning medals. Getting dropped. Okay, personal challenges. There's a lot of trying to shift people's attitudes and behaviours. And it doesn't matter what name you give yourself, we're all coaches. And what I want to talk about in the next sort of 30 minutes are 7 characteristics that I think I've observed over a 20-year career working across a wide range of sports, that the best coaches, the really exceptional coaches, possess these skill sets. Okay. The first thing that every great coach knows is that a tomato is a fruit. Okay. Now, hopefully that's not a news flash for some of you in the room. Okay, it's a fruit. Your world's just ended. That's one part of it, right? But what really great coaches know is that although it's a fruit, you know, if you come around my house, I ain't going to give it to you with ice cream because it's going to be disgusting. You ain't going to have that as part of your pudding. Okay? So there's a difference between practical intelligence and intellectual intelligence. Street smarts and book smarts. Those practical skill sets on that T skills that has been spoken about by Andy, by Steve and by Barry. Okay? We need to understand that the best coaches not only have that depth of knowledge in their particular realm that they work in, but they also have the experience and the softer skills to put in place. So we mustn't mistake education for intelligence. So, you know, getting your degree, I used to do martial arts, it's a bit like getting your black belt. I trained for 3 years. I thought I was amazing. I was pretty amazing. I got my black belt, and then I had to go to the black belt class. You don't need to stay in the colour belt class, you moved up to the black belt class. Well, that was great. And then all of a sudden, I'm sitting in a room full of freaking black belts. And I'm a first degree black belt, and there's fourth, fifth, seventh, eighth degree black belts. And all of a sudden, I'm getting my ass kicked again. So going to university is a bit like getting your black belt. You get your black belt, you think you're a ninja, but the reality is you haven't got the softer skill sets. You haven't got that experience to back it up. You only get that through time. Recently been reading a fantastic book called Creativity Inc. And it's written by Ed Catmull, and he has he created Pixar animation. Okay, so the guys that do Monsters Inc. and Toy Story. And one of the things they talk about are field trips. And every sport that I've worked with, I've seen the value of field trips. So basically what he does with all of their teams, whenever they're making a new film, if we use the example of Monsters University, they sent all the creative crew out to universities in America, all the big sort of Ivy League ones. They spent days walking the halls, looking at the notice boards. They spent time at a frat house, going to the library, eating in the dining room, staying in the dorms. Because what they found on all of their films, when they have these field trips, they don't really know the purpose on the outset, but by being part of it, by experiencing it, it adds a layer of context and authenticity that when we watch the film, it resonates and we're like, actually, this is real, even though it's about a big blue furry monster. Okay, and that's the key. I've just started working with a new sport and I've been doing some field trips. One was in deepest, darkest Wales a few weeks ago. The other was in California last week. Tough life. But the deepest, darkest Wales, the first one, the riders are like, well, why do you want to come out of us? This is just like a normal sort of training day. And I didn't really have an answer at the time. I didn't really know what I was going to get from that field trip. But by being there early in the morning with the mist coming in and seeing the mechanics setting up the bikes, loading up the trailers, seeing what food the athletes were or were not taking with them. A potato sandwich was one of them, okay, kid you not. Loading it up, traveling up to where we were going to do the downhill runs, seeing the train, seeing the conditions, walking the course with the coach. I couldn't have told you at the start of the day what I was going to get from that field trip. But I came away with a much better understanding, and all of a sudden the athletes are looking at me thinking, oh, actually, he does start to understand our sport a bit more. He does give a monkey's about what we're doing. He is invested in it. So, you know, we need to have that deep domain knowledge. We need to understand the technical stuff. But more importantly than that, we need to immerse ourselves in the sports and the environments that we're doing to get that context and get that trust. So we need to always remember a tomato is a fruit. I've never met Tony, and hopefully he won't be offended that I liken him to a cockroach, but all coaches should aspire to be a cockroach. And I know that's not, you know, like horrible little things, isn't it? They scuttle around, but we should all want to try and be cockroaches, and here's why. Cockroaches and dinosaurs were knocking around the world at a similar sort of time, and one lot made it, one lot didn't. Okay, because cockroaches are adaptable little buggers. Okay, they can survive. Scientists even think that they can survive nuclear attacks. And what you'll find is that all these cockroaches, there's ones that can live in jungles, there's ones that can live in urban places, there's one that lives in kitchens of restaurants that I visit. You know, they're flexible and they are adaptable. They use the past as a teacher rather than being constrained by it. And again, if you look at sort of Asian and the Middle East, if you go to Korea and Japan and places, they talk about exceptional coaches maintain this beginner's mindset. And I think these are some of the things that Steve alluded to. When you walk into a new sport, I always say to them, I'm going to be the dumb kid in the class here. I'm going to be asking you all the stupid questions. Just bear with me. And sometimes it gives me that, I can do that because I say straight at the start, I don't really understand your sport. I'm going to ask you loads of stupid questions. But what it allows you to do by having that beginner's mindset is that it allows you to sort of challenge the cliches and the facts. I started working in professional football 4 years ago, and we were told, as a fact, that a certain player couldn't decelerate, or he can't stop. He's got terrible deceleration. So we asked a stupid question, well, why? And they all started talking amongst themselves. Everyone had been at the club for 5 or 6 years. Well, do you remember that time? Do you remember that game he was playing? And he just clattered that defender. He ran into him, battered him, knocked him over. Yeah, yeah. So the fact that he had no deceleration skills came from one incident in one game where he wiped someone out. When we actually looked at it and did some basic analysis, actually, okay, his deceleration skills weren't horrific, but it was something to work on. We were using sort of smoke and mirrors and mysticism as fact. But by going in and having this beginner's mindset and always asking and always challenging, I think you will be more successful than if you have a closed mindset, than if you're a dinosaur and you just do the same old, over and over again. Okay, you've got to be flexible and adaptable as coaches. The other thing you need to do, you've got to be a cockroach, you've got to be a pig as well. All right. This is one of the coaches I worked with leading into 2012. So when I get up this morning and I want to have a bit of breakfast, okay, there's a few things I like on my breakfast plate. Okay, one of them is eggs. I love an egg. So I go up and I want an egg. Well, the hen, it's not a problem. You want an egg, Nick? I want an egg. It'll pop out an egg. I can have one egg. Tomorrow, if I want another egg, do you know what? Let's go crazy. I'll have two. Bangs out two for me. It can do that over and over again because the hen is involved in the process of making the eggs. Now, there's nothing better than a bit of bacon to go with your eggs, right? But the poor old pig's now looking at me sideways like, oh, shit. She's only going one way for the pig. Because if I want bacon on my plate, I can't just walk up and just take a rasher off its arse and then the pig's getting it. The pig's like, oh, well, okay, you want the bacon? I'm committed. I am. The pig is the process. The hen is involved in the process. The pig is the process. So you have to be in sport, in high performance sport, or any level of sport that you're working, it's a 2 feet in job. You know, Barry alluded to the amount of time that it takes to create success. It's not the okey pokey. You can't put one foot in and dibble around. I'll have a little bit of that because it's quite good. It's long hours. It's not always recognized. You've got to be fully committed. 2 feet in. The gymnast that I was talking about at the start, he tested, oh, sorry, I always get a little bit click happy. He tested me right at the start of that rehab phase. So he comes in and he says, Nick, I'm going to see Oasis at the weekend. I was like, you've got a broken hand, mate. What are you talking about? I mean, he had some stupid ideas. He was a pain, but this was one of his daftest. I was like, you've got a broken hand. We ain't got long. We've got a window of opportunity. What? No, it's all right. I've got it all under control. I'm going to drive with the other hand, and my girlfriend's going to change gears. Now, this was from Lillishaw to London. It's about 150-odd miles. I'm like, this can't happen. And I laid out all the reasons why this was a stupid idea, one of his most stupid ideas. And it was at that point he challenged me. He went, I'll tell you what, let me have a think. He says, if I can get you a ticket, will you drive me down there, look after us in the concert? Because Oasis concerts ain't a tea party. It's all kicking off in there. There's bottles coming in, all sorts. You look after us, make sure I'm safe, will you do it? And it was at that point I'm thinking, that ain't even my freaking job description. I don't see anything like chaperoning people. To like, yeah, do you know what? I'll do it. I didn't even really like Oasis at the time. So I drove him down there, drove him back, made sure he didn't get into any trouble, drove him back, because at the start of the rehab process, I'd said, we'll do whatever we can to get you there. And he asked me the question, will you do this? Yeah. My missus still didn't, she was like, seriously, you're driving someone to see a concert? It's part of the process. So you've got to be 2 feet in. A lot of what we do is grunt work. It's behind the scenes. As Barry said, you're not going to be stood on there giving it big licks and selfies. That's not why we got into the job. Okay, we got into the job because we want to make a difference. And a lot of that happens behind the scenes. And I can't give you the passion. If you're sitting there thinking, well, I wouldn't do that, or I don't fancy doing that, then it's probably not the job for you. Okay, I can't instill that passion and enthusiasm into people. The next skill that I think all high performance coaches have is the ability to motivate. And for a long time, I didn't think it was my job as a coach to motivate athletes. I was like, do you know what? You're getting 40 bags a week. You're winning medals. Why should I be motivating you? You know, my job is to give you training. But I was a bit of a hard ass back in the day. It's like, you just should be getting on and be grateful that you're an athlete. But actually, there are times when training, if you've been doing it for 15, 20 years, it's a ball ache. If you've had virtually the same warm-up every day, twice a day, it's dull. So there are times when we as coaches sometimes need to shake our pom-poms because the frustration is going to kill that session. If I give you an example of when I had to get my pom-poms out, the emergency pom-poms, they don't come out very often, but every now they do. Leading into London 2012, I was working with women's basketball team, and we were one of the first teams to go through Loughborough at the holding camp. So we got all our kit the first day, which is kind of cool. You go in, get fitted out, all looking smart. It takes ages. And then we go for our first training session, and weirdly, it was flat. Everyone was like proper, I think they were a bit tired from the day before, but also there was a stark reality that, gee, in less than a week, we are going to be competing at home Olympics, and we're on show. So the mood was flat as a pancake. So the coach comes up, Tom comes out, he says, Nick, right, we've only got like five or six sessions. I don't care what you do, you just need to get these girls sorted in the next 10 minutes for your warm-up. So, oh, cheers, coach, no pressure. And as I look up on the balcony, as with all major championships, there was all these people in suits all getting around. Because we were the first ones. And I can imagine the comment, oh, what you can see here is the British basketball team, yes. And this young chap there, yes, with the shaved head, he's going to be doing a very thorough warm-up, adhering to the ramp protocol. It's going to be amazing. Sports science, yes, bloody brilliant. And I'm sitting there thinking, what am I going to do? Flipping heck. So I went to the best warm-up that I've ever come across. I only picked it up the week before from my then seven-year-old daughter, at Brownies, okay? And what we were going to do, well, I'll tell you what, we'll do it with you lot, all right? Everybody stand up. Here we go. Come on, let's get you up. Because you're looking a bit like the basketball team did that morning, flat as a flipping pancake. Look at you. All right, so what we did, this is like cutting-edge sports science here. We played the bean game. Anyone played the bean game? I'll explain it. There's loads of variations, right? So what I do, I'll call out a bean. Whatever bean I call out, you've got to do it. So if I say, I'll start with the easy ones, running bean, you got to run on the spot, okay? You haven't got to start yet, Steve, I like your enthusiasm, that's good, okay? If I say jumping bean, guess what, you've got to jump up and down, okay? If I say jelly bean, you've got to go wibble wobble, all right? If I say Mexican bean, we're getting a bit fruity now, we go arriba, arriba, top of your voices. And if I say French bean, ooh la la, okay? You ready? Ready to go? Look at you, loving this now, you're like, shit, paid 100 odd quid to come to this. Right, okay, running bean, on the spot, come on, here we go, running bean. Some of you aren't doing it, I can see it in the back. Jumping bean, here we go. Mexican bean. Hold on, that was rubbish. Right, let's go again, come on, running bean. Jumping bean. Jelly bean. Yeah. French bean. Okay, sit down. I can make people do anything. It's brilliant. But a bit like you lot, as soon as we'd done that, it was a bit of a sort of shits and giggles thing. It just lifted the mood, got them ready, we could get them back in. That warm-up then became our sort of, if in emergency, break glass with the girls. We'd only use it once a camp, but once every, you know, the girls would come in, when are we doing the bean game? When are we going to do that? We're not doing it yet. And we always used it, it was nearly always in the week before a major game, and it was just like a little bit of a pressure release. I can't do that with the first team football club that I work with. I get absolutely rinsed by the lads. But so you've got to pick the team and understand your team about what will work with them. But sometimes we as the coaches have to... I did it again, didn't I? I'm having a shot there. Sometimes we as coaches have to raise the game. Vern Gambetta talks about ice. He always looks for ice in his training sessions. Has it got intensity? Is there concentration and is there effort? And he says, if there's those three things in a training session, then you're going to win the workout. And that's what we should always be looking for. And as much as I want this from my athletes, I also want this from the coaches and the support staff. So if you are that member of support team that's going, oh, he's a crap bunch of athletes, they never work hard, this team's always a nightmare, they never put the effort in. Well, mate, do you know what? Maybe it's not the athletes. Maybe it's you. Maybe you're the mood hoover, sapping the energy, coming in, going, I've done this warm-up 10 times. Maybe they're feeding off of you. So I'll throw it back on you. As well as having the athletes, highly motivated. For us as coaches, it takes zero talent to be 100% enthusiastic and going for it. You've got to put your game face on sometimes, and you've got to shake your pom-poms. I'm just mindful that Steve knows this guy quite well. So I'm sure this story is true, because I'm sure I saw the video from Matthew Pinson talking about it. But Matthew Pinson talks about this coach, Jürgen Grobler. And great coaches are really effective at communicating. Okay, we need to be able to tweet. We need to be able to get our messages across in 140 characters or less. So the story goes that one of their first training sessions, they're out there on the lake or whatever it is they work on, and they're giving it the big licks. That's how you row in it, Steve, like that. And they're going down, and Jürgen's on the towpath, and he's on his bike with his little Aulnay or whatever they do. I'm very, very stereotypical. And they can't hear anything. And Matthew Pinson's like, because prior to that, they were used to people just giving, like, running commentaries. And they're rowing, and they're rowing, and they still can't hear anything. And they get to the end, like a turnaround point, and the boat goes over the edge. And it's at that point he gives two or three key coaching points, sets them off, back they go. That's someone that can tweet. That's someone that can get their message across shortly and succinctly. 140 characters or less. When we're coaching, it's not our time to show people how clever we are with long words and fancy stuff. It's about getting the key points across when you need them to. We need to avoid being this sort of external hard drive for the athletes or someone that gives just running dialogue all the time. A lot of coaches are either fridges or Mrs. Donovan. Okay, so fridges, what does a fridge do? Apart from keep your food cold, right, we know that. It sits in the corner of the kitchen and it lets off a low hum. All day, every day, you haven't even noticed it. That's because you've zoned out. I've worked with coaches. I'm not going to do the impression because I know we've got people in football here, they might know who it is. But, you know, just stuff's coming out, noise. It's like players zone out after a while. They're not listening to it. So don't be a fridge. Don't be Mrs. Donovan. Mrs. Donovan was Charlie Brown's teacher. People remember Charlie Brown Peanuts? Some of you old. They've got a re-release, so it's contemporary now. But she used to sit there. And what did Mrs. Donovan used to do? She said, wah, 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 wah. That was the noise that came out of her. Hopefully that's not what you're getting from this presentation. But that was the noise that came out from Mrs. Donovan. The kids weren't listening to what she was, it was just drivel. So as coaches, we need to make sure that the messages we get across are short and succinct and powerful. We don't want to be sat in the corner just making noise. Because what our coaching needs to do is, we need to actually, again, help our athletes learn and understand what they're doing. Rather than just changing short-term the practice, the skill, we actually want them to be able to go away when they're not with us and actually have an impact and a learning effect. Two of the best coaches I've ever worked with, Waimarama Tuiama and Lynn Gunson, when I worked at England Netball. Without doubt, the best coaches I've worked with. And really shaped me as a practitioner and sort of epitomised this ability to walk the talk. You know, they developed trust with their players and their support staff. They laid down what were going to be acceptable behaviours for us as a team. We, you know, for the first time, the squad had duties that they had to do. They had to unload the bus, load the bus. They had people that looked after the laundry. They had people that looked after entertainments. They created this culture of, you don't just rock up and the support staff do everything for you. You work with that team. What are our acceptable behaviours? They did what they said they were going to do, which is really important for us as coaches. You know, if I can give an example again, like, if I go look at my family, we like a bit of a bike ride every now and then. So if we go out on a bike ride, my family, right, we're all there, helmets on. All right, I've got my helmet on, Joe's got his on, Erin's got hers on, me and Mrs. has got hers on, we're all down. Look ridiculous, riding our bikes. I say you ride a bike, a bit like how you row. And we've all got our helmets on. Now, coming down a towpath on the other way is the cool family. They're a little bit too cool for school. They've got, like, good haircuts, looking a bit slicker than us. None of them have got helmets on. They're free spirits. They don't care. If I fall over, a bit of claret comes out, it doesn't matter. So I kind of get that, because it's like one in, all in. None of them have got helmets on. But then there's the weird family. These are the weirdos. Hopefully none of you are the weird family. Okay? You see the family, mum and dad, air flowing, kids, helmets on. Well, how does that work? Because I know in my family, if I'd done that, right, if I rocked up on the driveway, looking there, no helmet on, Joe, stick your helmet on. Well, you ain't got yours on, Dad. That would be the conversation, and then that's me done. And that's about developing the trust and walking the talk. Whatever you do as coaches, Steve said there, being on time, making sure you follow through on reports, making sure you get information to people. That's where the trust comes. You've got to do that early and then maintain it all the way through. You can't expect your athletes and the people that you work with to be doing something if you're not prepared to go there as well. Okay, so you've always got to make sure you've got your helmet on when you're going for a ride. They won't thank me for those photos either. That's like 20 years old, that photo, so they'll be proper annoyed. But trying to get both of them in one photo was very difficult. This is John Wooden, one of the great basketball coaches from America. And I'd recommend anyone that works in coaching or any sort of support system should read his material. He talks about the glories in getting there. And that's something that, you know, again, looking at Barry's slide there, that 9 to 5, Barry just rocks up at 2 o'clock and just rocks the world. A lot have been going on there for a long time prior to that. And we have to recognise that as support staff. We don't want to be that full kit Wally, and there's some of those in football, and we can think of some of those that did that at European Championships recently, in recent years, that just turn up on the day to have their photo taken, having played no real part in that event. Okay, we've got to remember that the glory is in getting there, helping people achieve it, whether you are the school teacher that first turned that athlete onto sport, whether you are the physiologist that did their first lab test, whether you are the person that is there at the sharp end. Okay, it's not about the selfies and the recognition and the adulation. That's not why you're doing it. That's not why you would get into this. It's about the process. And I bore my family to tears. Every time an Olympics comes round, I will spot someone that I work with for a period of time. I can think of a cyclist that I worked with when she was 15 through to 17. I taught her how to squat. I taught her how to lift safely and competently. That's not why she won a gold medal. She was already going to be a world beater. But what I did was make sure that when she transitioned to Manchester, she wasn't at an absolute car crash in terms of her physical preparation, that they had some raw materials to work on. So I do get a little sense of pride when you see them doing well 5, 10, 15, 20 years later. So we have to be patient. And again, this comes out of that book by Ed Cartmell, Creativity Inc. We've got to be authentic with what we do, consistent, and then that trust is established. We've talked about that a lot already in the conference. The athletes have to trust you. We've got to be prepared to work with ugly babies at times. And again, that means that you might be right at the start of the process, where it's kind of an ugly baby, it's moving quite funky, they're not an amazing athlete. You know, you might be working at a lower level of sport where everyone thinks that's not that important. It's really important. That's where you can screw everything up, right at the beginning. Your job at the start is to nurture that ugly baby, work with it, and then help it flourish into a beautiful swan. So I've gone proper quick through this, so hopefully there's some questions at the end. But I want to sort of remind you of the key points. And this is a young coach. I actually coached Barry when he was a gymnast. And now he's going on to do really good things in men's artistic gymnastics. So it's not always about the old guys. Okay, sometimes the young ones are coming through and delivering. But what we have to remember, to be a great coach, you've got to have that deep domain knowledge. But you've also got to have a significant amount of experience. Getting out there on the field trips. Even if you don't know where those field trips are going to lead you to, what questions are going to answer, you've got to get out there and immerse yourself in as many different realms as possible. So whenever I'm asked about what should I do to gain experience, I'm like, work with individual sports, work with team sports, able-bodied, disabled, male, female, young, old. Go and just observe it. Go and just watch sport. Just watch live sport. See the speeds that the ball moves at. See the speed that they come past you out on their bikes. And I'm like, wait. Dan, where's the trail gone, Dan? He's like, That's it, mate. They go off there and down. I'm like, you're having a laugh, ain't you? It gives you a sense of enormity of, well, if this rider's going to go off here at 50 mile an hour on a push bike, which is ridiculous, I better make sure they are robust and ready to go. So that gives me a sense of, this is quite real. Because if you watch it on TV or you see it on a picture, you don't get the sense of the speed and the depth. So it's really important that you develop both that intellectual intelligence, but also that practical intelligence, street smarts and book smarts. You've got to be the pigs. Everyone's got to be hashtag pigs after my presentation, all right? You've all got to be pigs. To be successful, it is a 2 feet in thing. Okay, I don't think you can. It's the sort of environment. Sport is not the sort of job where you're just in it a little bit and having a dabble. I think you become very frustrated, and the athletes and the people that you work with will equally be frustrated. You're all in shared ambitions. That's something that I have with all the athletes that I work with. I share their ambitions, so I get as upset when they're upset when they've not been successful. I feel that as well. Okay. When I worked with GB basketball, we had a great record at the Olympics, 5-0. We didn't win a game. Okay, we went so close in one of the games against France. It was unbelievable. It's the only time that I've had that. I felt physically sick watching a game. We went to overtime. We almost beat them, and then their bloody little point guard, little short French person, stepped back, double teamed, put a 3-point in, just killed us. Absolutely killed us. And there was me, grumpy, walking back through the Olympic Village, and all the games makers dead happy on their did you have a nice night? No, I didn't have a nice night. Because for that, it took me about 2 hours to get that out of my system. Because you share the ambition, because I'm invested in this. This is what we're doing. We've got to try and win. So you should suffer with them and rejoice with them when it goes well. You've got to be cockroaches, hashtag cockroaches as well. Okay, there's a lot of hashtags going on here. The best coaches maintain that open mindset. So keep that beginner's mindset, always be questioning, going in there, asking, so that you are flexible and adaptable. So you're not just going to be a dinosaur that gets left over and saying, well, I've got 20 years experience, but really it's the 1 year that you've just repeated every 20 years. Okay, be the person that's continually shifting their craft along. Walk the talk. Okay, if you say you're going to do something, make sure you do it. Sounds very simple, but I think that's where people come unstuck. And the key is that's how you're going to develop the trust with your athletes. If they trust you, they'll do what you tell them to. Every now and then, you've got to shake your pom-poms. Training, just accept that the process of training can be frustrating, it can be boring. It is a job. Ultimately, it will be a job for them. So we as coaches have to find ways of trying to make that fun. Enjoy the small moments, okay? We've got to get out there and make it a little bit more enjoyable. Last week, we did a training session with the riders on a nudist beach. We didn't think it was going to be very busy because it's February in San Diego, and the guy that was doing it is like, oh, no one will be out there because it's quite cold, Nick. Wow, there were some people out there. One of them looked like a baby horse. It was incredible. But we've now got that. As a poor old Rach, I think it's forever ingrained on her mind. She didn't know where to look. But as a conversation point, in those dark days, we can always go back to that. I took them kayaking that afternoon to try and find whales. We didn't find a single freaking whale in 2 hours in the middle of the ocean. So again, halfway through that week, when we were doing a grinding out session and they were hating it, they were like, well, it could be worse. We could be kayaking with Nick looking for freaking whales. So it's the little things that give you that conversation and enjoyment that you should be trying to look for. So sometimes you have to shake your pom-poms. Effective coaches tend to say the least at the most important times. I think that's very hard sometimes when you're working as a coach, particularly when you've got either your peer group or parents or significant others around. You feel that you have to give a running dialogue and show everyone how clever you are. Most of my training sessions when I'm working in the gym, I just sit back and watch. Wait for the end of the set. Nothing's bad going to happen in the middle of the set if I've programmed it right. I'll give you a debrief midway through the rest period. Okay, so we just need to think about getting our message across short and succinct. Don't be a fridge. Don't sit in the corner just talking rubbish. And don't be Mrs. Donovan. And then finally, regardless of wherever you're working, whether you are at grassroots sport or whether you're working at Olympic level, it's not about you. It's not about how important you think you are, okay? It's about the athlete. We're all trying to get the athlete to a certain point, whether it's a personal best, a season best, an Olympic wedding, Olympic winning medal. One of the final slides to leave you with is this one, taken from the book Legacy, written by James Kerr. Another great book to read, charts the progress of the New Zealand rugby team and why they're so successful. And what we're trying to do, in a small way, is create legacies. That gymnast that I described at the start, so 2000, one spot for a male gymnast at the Olympics. He went on to make the final. At the time, he was the most successful male British gymnast that had ever been. I'm convinced that the fact that he came back from there, having been the most successful, would have helped subsequent funding applications, would have given some inspiration to a young junior gymnast, and, you know, in no small part would be part of that ongoing legacy for the success of a sport like gymnastics that has started to clean up in recent years. So it's about creating those legacies so that whatever sports we work with, they are in a better place when we leave than when we started. That's what we should all be doing. Thank you very much.
Nick is asked about the blend of personalities between the coach and athlete to get the best out of each other.
I think there'll always be a fit that works, and whether that... I can think of an athlete that I started working with last year, and that working relationship lasted about 6 weeks. And I probably knew on the first meeting that it wasn't right, but I went against my gut instinct and tried to pursue it. And we were just... I probably wanted to be a bit too much of a bull and push his training a certain way, which was almost like a 360 degree turn for him, you know, a complete shift. And I probably tried to do that a little bit too aggressively, and we just lasted about 6 weeks and we agreed to go our separate ways. And a colleague of mine is now working with him and making great gains. And I think it's often that personality fit. I think you know pretty quick how it's going to work out. I think one of the things as coaches, you have to be a bit of a chameleon. You've got to be a chameleon now, hashtag chameleon. That's a new slide. You have to be able to adapt your coaching style to the group that you're working with. So the way that I coach when I'm with the football team will be different to the way that I coach the female mountain biker who's had the perfect season last year and is a world champion. She's got a very different mindset and a way of communicating, so I have to draw upon my experience with success with other female athletes, whereas, you know, it's a different approach with the men. So I guess the onus is probably on us to be able to adapt to the athletes.
Nick is asked about the changing dynamic in teams and how to manage specialists.
I think it will depend on every situation. I think I feel it's got better. So I remember when I first started as an S&C coach, it was very much everyone working in silos and not really talking. Well, you're the boffin in the lab and you're the guy out on the pitch and I think everyone did work in those compartments. I think now the most successful teams are those multidisciplinary teams where everyone's comfortable talking. So I know at the club that I work at and consult with at the moment, we've got quite a long established sports science and medicine team, which is unusual in professional football, because the way the club's set up is that despite a manager coming in, that support team stay constant. And I think it's quite flat, so we're all quite comfortable challenging each other and asking questions. And, you know, the physios will come in and watch our gym sessions and vice versa, and we'll all try and upskill each other. Because, again, ultimately, we all share the same ambitions and we're all trying to get that team to be successful. So I think, in general, it's getting better. And I think I know in my experience, with the team I'm working with the downhill mountain bike guys, I saw a massive gap in what was being delivered, that I knew that I couldn't deliver that. My skill set was lacking. So it was having the confidence to phone someone up and say, help, can you come in and help me? It wasn't a sign of weakness. So I think we are getting better at communication, yeah. I think there are certain sports will require probably more of a specialist input. I think the strength for me, I realised quite early on, given the breadth of sports that I've worked with, that I like to be a specialist generalist. That was sometimes looked down upon, really. It's like a jack of all trades, but I don't think that's actually the case. I think the fact that I've worked across such a breadth of sports allows me to come in and lean on, you know, experience across 30 plus different sports and ask the silly questions that no one else is asking. I think there are then times when I recognise I've got a gap because I've got a broad experience, and I can pick the phone up and say, right, I need you to come in and answer this very specific question. We use a biomechanist as a consultant, Paul Bryce, and we bring him into the club. He's not there every day, all day, but when we've got a real problem that we're thinking, do you know what, we just can't quite nail this down as to why his running mechanics isn't right or why his acceleration, deceleration isn't right, we'll pick up the phone and get him in, because he can walk in and he's a specialist in that, and he can just, in a session, answer the questions. And that's the blend, I guess. I think we should I get comfortable with being a specialist generalist. I think that's a good way to go, personally. Based on my experience, I've worked a lot in team sports. So I think within a team sport environment, you tend to be more of a specialist generalist, because you will do warm-ups, you'll do strength sessions, you'll do endurance sessions, so recovery, rehab. So you tend to be a little bit more involved. I think when you get to some of those more individual sports, where it is much more outcome-driven and numbers, it's from start to finish and it's timed, I think that's when you probably do really need the guys that are laser-focused and very specialist in what they're doing.
Nick offers his tips for sustaining performance for those in the middle of their performance career.
I'd go back to that beginner's mindset. I think, so when I left the Institute, that sounds like I left the Institute. When I left the English Institute, it was a little bit like that. In 2007, I think one of the things I was really conscious of, I was going out as a consultant on my own, and all of a sudden my network would be lost. So I worked really hard at maintaining that network, maintaining the connections around the countries you alluded to and throughout the world, so that those conversations were ongoing, and putting myself in rooms with people that are far cleverer than me and trying to roll with them, struggling sometimes. But I think network when you're mid-career is really important, and also that beginner's mindset, being uncomfortable with knowing sort of what you don't know, knowing what your weak spots are, and try and plug those weak spots either with your own education and knowledge or by drafting in your super team around you. So again, I think it will cater and appeal to different individuals. I know when I was with netball, I didn't want to leave netball. I loved working with that squad of players and the coaches, but I knew that probably for career longevity, I mean, there's only five nations that are really competitive. So I was working with one of the best and best paid in England. So if I wanted to go New Zealand or Australia, well, that's a long way away, and they're probably not going to pay as well. And I was conscious that I'd become the netball specialist, which would probably get old after about 5 years. So going to somewhere like the English Institute, all of a sudden, you're in a gym, and on every platform, there's a different athlete with a slightly different take on it. And then I've got physios coming in. And I think what has happened is over the years with all the different sports, it does reignite your passion. Going into action sports, which is a realm I've not worked in before, where everyone kept telling me they're going to be loose and crazy, and you know, watching people bombing down a mountainside, I'm like, this is freaking mental. This is nothing like my day job at the football club. It's very different. So yeah, it really does fuel your passion. So I personally like that challenge of going into a new sport and trying to reinvent myself almost. But I know there are people that are very happy within one realm, team sports or football or rugby. I guess you just have to decide which way you want to go.
For more recordings from the Supporting Champions Conference or our podcast, visit the Performance Vault at supportingchampions.co.uk. You can also log in to join the discussion live, or you can join us at one of the Supporting Champions events for performance-focused development and networking.